So I'll acknowledge that this Dharma talk feels, I'm feeling a little more raw giving this Dharma talk than usual. Just feeling a lot of emotions right now around all this. The topic is an odd one for a Dharma talk, extremism. And the first thing I'll presence is that we're living in an extreme moment right now. As we all know, there's been more than a few unfortunate deaths of people of color, many at the hands of law enforcement. And there's a lot of trauma right now. I mean, it's been trauma for all of us to witness this, and the trauma is ongoing. And trauma always presents us with a few questions. One of the questions of trauma is, how deep into vulnerability can I go? Another question that trauma asks is, how big an experience can I hold? How big an experience can I contain with mindfulness and compassion? And perhaps the most important question that trauma asks us is, what happens when I get overwhelmed? What do I do when I get overwhelmed? You know, and I'll name that it's part of white privilege that when white people get overwhelmed by the conversation around race, we have the option to leave. We can walk away. Too much for me. I'm going to leave, you know. And that's part of privilege because, of course, people of color, when they get overwhelmed, it's not like they can magically go someplace where they're not experiencing racism, you know. And so it's this funny balance, you know, on the one hand, self-care is so important. It's so important to be able to come to these, to this, to all these things from a place of balance and from a place of being, you know, in, you know, nourished. And yet it's also important not to, you know, not for me as a white person, say, to use my privilege to hide, use my privilege to escape. You know, and so what is the possibility of remaining engaged even when we're overwhelmed? What is the possibility for remaining, you know, continuing to feel even when we're at the limit of what we can feel, you know, because in some sense that is exactly how we grow our container for being able to contain more. You know, and I acknowledge it has a bit of a flavor of impossibility, you know. How do I remain engaged even when I'm too overwhelmed to engage, you know, this sort of thing. It almost has the flavor of sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them, you know. It's this thing, the logical mind says, well, that's impossible, you know. And it's precisely by walking in the direction of what the logical mind finds impossible that we expand the field of possibility. So I'm going to read a long quote. This is a quote from a truly astonishing American document. A document I'm sure many of you know. It's called Letter from a Birmingham Jail by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I've been thinking a lot about this passage over the past week. So he says, I've not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. Rather, I've tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled into the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. And now this approach is being termed extremist. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continue to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and do good to those who hate you, and pray for those which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like the waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I can do no otherwise, so God help me. And John Bunyan, and I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we'll be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's hills, three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment, but the other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. So that question has been knocking, sort of rolling around in me. What kind of extremist will we be? What kind of extremist will I be? And it's tricky, Of course, the word extremism, it's not a pretty word. It gets a lot of bad press because I'd say there's a very shallow kind of extremism that is an extremism that is not connected at all to love, to vulnerability, to tenderness. And of course, when you're not connected to any of that, then it's easy to bulldoze through the world and commit violence and that sort of thing, An extremism that is committed to feeling deeply, to loving, to feeling empathy and compassion toward others. Of course, it would have to be nonviolent. It would be a very different thing. So what insight does Buddhism give on this? And it's funny to approach Buddhism with this lens. Buddhism is funny because on the one hand, it's the middle way. It's the way between extremes, so it's always about finding that balance. And yet, if you think about it, this whole thing called Buddhism, how did it start? Started with this guy who had such a breakthrough experience that he walked out and left his family behind, walked away from his family, went out into the woods, did all kinds of crazy things, half starved himself, that sort of thing, finally came to a tree and said, I'm not going to get up until I achieve my goal. This is the story of Prince Siddhartha. This is an extreme guy in some ways, And some of the things that Buddhism asks of us, get rid of attachment to the ego. These are incredibly difficult extremes. And so it's this paradox of how to hold, the things that are balanced between extremes and the things that are extreme, I often come back to, when I think about Buddhism, a few things else I could say. I think first I'll say that one of the ways I understand Buddhism is there's a profound yes to everything. And right now, of course, we're experiencing all this trauma, Buddhism is not what I'd call the superficial yes, the superficial, you know, psychopathic yes of, well, yes, there are problems and it doesn't bother me, you know, like that kind of thing. It's yes to a messy, painful world. It's yes to a world that always demands my compassion. You know, because it's precisely through having my compassion demanded that I am able to walk my path of Dharma, you know. And in particular, I think I would say that, you know, all the conversations around privilege, you know, here I am a straight white male, you know, and so I carry white privilege, I carry male privilege, I carry, you know, hetero privilege, straight privilege. Privilege is essentially an inflation of the ego. And so all these conversations about deconstructing privilege are all about deflating the ego in some way. And so I see them very much consistent with the core idea of Buddhism, you know? And in fact, in some ways, I consider myself profoundly lucky to live in a time when there is such a sophisticated conversation around tearing down white privilege, tearing down male privilege, you know, and that I can be part of these conversations and that they can play so deeply into my own spiritual work. I often think also of the four illimitable minds, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You know, and what would it mean to be an extremist of one of these? What would be an extremist of equanimity, you know? What would it mean to be so balanced that you could walk into an unbalanced situation and bring balance to it, you know? Like, you know, what would that look like? What would it to be an extremist of loving kindness and compassion? I often say that I consider Christianity to be the world's premier teaching on love. I consider Buddhism to be the premier teaching on happiness, you know, and in Christianity, the premier teaching on love. And I don't know to what extent you've had a chance to read through the Christian Gospels. They really are quite extraordinary. The one thing that blows me away time and time again when I look at the Gospels is how powerful and how consistent the message is from Jesus that the kind of love he's talking about is a love that cuts across all boundaries of otherness. You know, if you look at his behavior, he's associating with all the social outcasts, the lepers, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, the zealots, all the people that the religious authorities are saying, you know, those are outcasts. You shouldn't bother with them, you know. And he was actually being criticized for having feasts with these people. You know, at one point he preaches, you know, what's the most important commandment? And he said one of them is love God, and the other is love thy neighbor as thyself. And a lawyer who really wants to understand says, he hears love thy neighbor as thyself, and he says, well, all right, so who is my neighbor? And he immediately tells the story, the famous story of the Good Samaritan. Now, you have to understand, in those days, ancient Israelites and Samaritans, it was kind of like, you know, Israelis and Palestinians now. It was like two groups with bad blood between them. They didn't like each other. Like, you know, there was an incredibly strong boundary of otherness between these two categories. And this tale of the Good Samaritan, someone who is a Samaritan from the other side, he goes out of his way to help a Jewish man who's in trouble with incredible compassion and incredible generosity, you know? And so his very example tale is, you know, you want to know what love is? It's about crossing a boundary of otherness, you know? And this even played out after the death of Jesus into the Acts of the Apostles. You know, they were having this conversation. Some of the first Christians were all Jews, and they were all in the Jewish community, and it was this real question are we going to open this Christianity thing up to people who are non-Jews? And the powerful answer that they decided on was yes. You know, anyone. This has to be something that is open to everyone, open across all boundaries of otherness. Yesterday was the Feast of Pentecost, which in many ways is regarded as the birthday of the church. And so think about that in our own day, love across otherness. And of course, all the work around the conversation of race and deconstructing my own white privilege, my own male privilege, is all about how do I love across the boundary of otherness? And that's really the love that matters. Jesus says in another place in the Gospels, if you love only your family and your own kind, well, what good is that? Everyone does that. In other words, you don't get credit for that. What really counts as love is love that crosses boundaries of otherness. And as Jung makes clear, that if I'm going to do the work of loving across boundaries of otherness in the external world, the only way I can sustain that is to love my internal otherness. And the more I can love my internal otherness, the more I can love the otherness I find in the world. All the places that are naturally othered, the places, I don't want to feel that place, that kind of thing, shame and fear and grief and all the difficult emotions. And in this way, the work of profound self-love really supports a very robust, generous kind of love across boundaries of otherness. You could even say in some ways that self-love is almost a political act, insofar as I engage in this tremendously, deeply intimate work of self-love, I'm more available to these challenging conversations, And Buddhism is tricky. It's many things, and certainly part of what Buddhism offers to us, the techniques of meditation and mindfulness are grounding techniques, they're calming techniques. And so one thing that Buddhism can do is learn to help us relax, learn to help us find some inner silence, learn to get a little refreshment. But of course, that's not what all of Buddhism, that Buddhism doesn't stop there. And there's this great quote from Joanna Macy. Let me find this quote. As far as Buddhism is concerned, I find that Western Buddhists go for peace of mind, and that is such an inadequate response. Peace of mind is a side benefit of Buddhism, but that's not, it's not like I get to peace of mind and I'm done. I'm not done, especially in the Mahayana view, I'm not done until all sentient beings are saved. I'm not done until I'm engaged in love with all living beings. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. Quote sheet is in the chat. And so I have the long quote from Letter from a Birmingham Jail at the top. And if you've never read that, it's something like the Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address. Like, every American should know this text. It's extraordinary. The first quote, there's a story that goes with this quote. So the story is from Aeschylus. Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. It's a very powerful quote. The story that goes along with this quote is that on April 4th, 1968, Robert Kennedy was campaigning for president. And he got on a plane to fly to Minneapolis. And when he got on the plane, he was getting on the plane, someone brought him the message, Dr. King has been shot in Memphis. And they didn't know how serious it was. And so the whole flight, they're worried, like, what are we going to do when we get to Indianapolis? And his speechwriters are trying to come up with something that would be appropriate. They land in Indianapolis. They get another message. Dr. King has passed away. He's been assassinated. And he was scheduled to go to a primarily black neighborhood in Indianapolis that night. And all his aides are telling him, don't go, we'll cancel. He insisted on going. And he didn't listen. They had cobbled together some kind of speeches to try and help him. He didn't want any of their notes. He spoke from the heart. And in fact, he began by telling the crowd of Dr. King's death. And for many, we forget, before the internet, this was the first news they had heard of it. They heard it from his lips. And he just gave this very heartfelt speech. It was actually the only time that he ever spoke publicly about the grief of losing his own brother. And he quoted that quote from Aeschylus. And he connected so deeply with that crowd that Indianapolis was the only major city that did not have riots that night. Sadly, he was assassinated 3 months later. From Ben Franklin, an interesting one. Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Are we here for our comfort and safety, or are we here to change the world, An intriguing one from the Marquis de Sade, not necessarily a poster child for virtue. There's no rational commensuration between what affects us and what affects others. The first we sense physically, and the other touches us morally. And, interesting from a man who was not only a sadist, but the man who gave us the name, the word sadist. Always remembering that bias of the ego, that how deeply something affects us, and how deep is my empathy? Can I really feel into how deeply something affects someone else? From Rabindranath Tagore, we come nearest to the great when we are great in humility. Abraham Flexner said, we must not overlook the role extremists play. They're gadflies that keep society from being too complacent or self-satisfied. They are, if sound, the spearhead of progress. If they are fundamentally wrong, free discussion will in time put an end to them. From that remarkable soul, Helen Keller, character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. It is only through the experience of trial and suffering that the soul can be strengthened, ambition inspired, and success achieved. Mr. Barry Goldwater, now I don't know that I would agree with a whole lot of things that Mr. Barry Goldwater said, but he did say, I would remind you that extremism is the defense, in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you that also moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. From Camus, our world does not need tepid souls, it needs burning hearts, men who know the proper place of moderation. From JFK, do not pray for easier lives, pray to be stronger men. A very blunt statement from Malcolm X, tell him and all the other moderate Negroes who are getting somewhere need to always remember that it was us extremists who made it possible. Similarly, the extremism of the founding fathers made America possible. It's good not to underestimate the value, how much extremists brought about what we have now. Poet Anne Sexton said, "Saints have no moderation, nor do poets, just exuberance." The Joanna Macy quote I quoted before, Yevgeny Yudashenkov said, "When truth is replaced by silence, silence is a lie." Pema Chodron says, "The ego seeks to divide and separate. Spirit seeks to unify and heal." H. Jackson Brown has this great quote, "Don't say you don't have enough time. You have exactly the same number of hours per day that were given to Helen Keller, Pasteur, Michelangelo, Mother Teresa, Leonardo da Vinci, Thomas Jefferson, and Albert Einstein." Max Lucado said, "Deflating even inflated egos is so important to God that he offers to help." And boy, does he ever offer to help. Melodomi Patrice Sime says, "A person in pain is being spoken to by that part of himself that knows only how to communicate that way." And that's true within the individual, and it's also true within the body politic, that when we see the outbreaking of rioting and pillaging and looting, in a way, what we're seeing is a kind of pain that has no other language, you know. And the question for me as a white man is always, in what ways am I complicit to not hearing those voices? And in what ways can I make myself more available to those voices so that they have another way to speak? Jillian Michael says, "A bad day for your ego is a great day for your soul." Roxanne Gay says, "It is your privilege that shapes what you get to worry about, and it's your lack of privilege that shapes what you must worry about." Susie Kissam says, "Always choose togetherness over otherness. That is the seed of unity. This is the only way to see all human beings as part of the same family. We may not always agree with our siblings, but we still love them anyway, unconditionally, the same way God loves us." And then finally, from a remarkable extremist, Greta Thunberg, who says, "We need to focus every inch of our being on climate change." There is a very powerful form of extremism that the world desperately needs.